affirmed it and invited to go back to our breathing, so that our collective energy of mindfulness will bring us together as an organism, going as a river, with no more separation. That the whole Sangha breathe as one body, generate peace as one body, be free as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of the elusive self, liberating from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
So welcome everyone. It's important that we understand that the practice of loving kindness, which Anne just led us through a little practice. You know, we talk about things in Buddhism such as non-self. Right? The practice of loving kindness is the practice of non-self. It is the practice of non-grasping. It is the practice in which we don't project our own stuff onto everyone else. Now, the practice of loving kindness means that we are developing the capacity to see everyone. No matter whether they share our political beliefs, whether they share our ethnic background, whether they come from the same country, same religion, or whatever, same socioeconomic class, etc., that we've let go of all those designations, and we see everyone as our friend. Why are they our friend? Because they are no different than us. They are human beings. They want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. They don't want their families to suffer. They don't want their friends to suffer. Right? And everyone in this world, no matter what their belief system are, or their socioeconomic status, religion, et cetera, intrinsically share that. And so to be able to offer loving kindness, which means kindness, right, friendship, to everyone, we have to drop a lot of our conditioning, don't we? We have to drop our own stuff. And we have to be willing to drop the myriad ways we divide up the world to those I like and those I dislike, those I agree with, those I don't agree with, those are good, those are bad, those are right, those are wrong, right? the way we divide up the world into friends and enemies and to most of the people who we are indifferent to. So the practice of non-self, the practice of oneness, the practice of interbeing, interconnection, all those spiritual words become real in the practice of loving kindness. When one is capable of seeing through the empty nature of distinctions, categorizations, prejudices, etc., and can see every human being just as they are. Quite simple that way. So it's a practice that is really central to our spiritual development. And of course, we need to make sure that we include our own self in that universe of non-judgment and non-discrimination, non-categorization. That each of us, just as we are, no matter who we are, what we've done or haven't done, or who we think we should be or shouldn't be, or what we hold ourselves guilty for or blame for or not, when we get down to the basics, we are just human beings who want to be happy, who would like to be free, who would like our loved ones and friends to enjoy the same things and would not like to have to suffer needlessly. So therefore, we offer loving kindness, a good friendship to everyone, everything. We offer it to animals, we offer it to plants, we offer it to the earth. It is a general, you know, people say, well, I understand the practice on the cushion, you know, the mindfulness practice, awareness of the breath practice, but what do I do when I get off the cushion? And again, most of us do not live on the cushion. most of us, our life occurs off the cushion. But that doesn't mean when we get off the cushion, we just allow our conditioned ways of relating to dominate us. So quite simply, when we're off the cushion, as we go about our day, home, family, friends, work, society, we offer loving kindness. We view our encounters with other human beings as encounters with friends. Sometimes our friends may be frustrating for us. Sometimes our friends, family, may do things that drive us a little crazy, right? Or we may disapprove of. But usually, whatever that is, those kinds of judgments or responses, reactions occur. If they're people we love and care about, they occur in that context, which is also usually a context of understanding. We try to understand them. We try to understand that maybe they are suffering. We understand that they may not know better, right? They may be in the control of their own conditioning. They may not have any distance or perspective on their own issues, on their own stuff, right? And so we are understanding of people who are our friends, right? It's good to extend that same type of understanding to everyone. I think we'll enjoy being, we'll enjoy life better. so it's kind of selfish too. We'll be happier people. we'll be calmer people, we'll be more open people, more accepting people. And please see your off-the-cushion practice as very much involved with the practice of loving kindness. And do your best to view other beings as friends and to interact even with strangers as if they were your friend. We're comfortable with friends, aren't we? We're relaxed with friends. We may be playful with friends, but comfortable. There's really, obviously, you know, if you're in a war zone or things like extreme places like that, the practice of this overt practice of loving kindness may be a little more difficult. But most of us don't exist in those kinds of extreme situations in our lives. So most of our holding back from offering freely loving kindness is our own defensiveness, our own reservedness, our own trust issues, walled offness, lack of open-heartedness. You know, it's our own stuff. Traditionally, you know, Buddhism is considered the Buddha called it a path of wisdom and compassion, a path of awakening, path of enlightenment, enlightened living. Thich Nhat Hanh very nicely calls it a path of healing and transformation. It's a path whereby we heal the parts of ourselves that are wounded, that are hurt, that are in pain. We heal them. And in that healing, transformation occurs. Our form begins to change. Our minds begin to change, our forms begin to change, our hearts begin to change. Transformation occurs. So the practice of loving kindness is one of those excellent practices to facilitate healing and to transform yourself and your capacity for relationship. So please enjoy it. It's a good practice. So before we return to Master Xu Yun, Empty Cloud, great Chan Zen master, lived 120 years, died in the 1960s, kind of a real thing, in the kind of came from the depth of the 19th century, 1800s, in very traditional Chan Zen China, and lived right into the Red Guards, and had experiences with them. Very interesting. So before we return to Xu Yun, are there any questions anyone has about the practice, their own practice, mindfulness, meditation, sitting, standing, walking? Please, if anything is not clear about your practice or about how to apply the practice in the issues of your daily life, please, we'll take a moment now. If you have any questions, please feel free to ask them. It takes a little courage for some of us to ask questions. Well, we think asking questions is like we're stupid or something.
Right.
Some kind of embarrassment we have. Like we're supposed to know it all. Yes?
I think tonight,
there's
a little
much.
No, 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 no. No one is going to ask a question.
Everybody got together beforehand.
I don't know. I think it was just a consensus without consensus.
Okay. I'll accept that. So for those of you who've been putting up with me for these last probably a couple of months. We're dealing with this discourse by Master Xu Yun, Master Empty Cloud. Probably the greatest modern-day Chinese Chan is Zen, and Chinese Master. And we've been dealing with just a discourse that he gave to his monks and lay people, senior monks, it says, on how to practice in the meditation hall. I believe we've gotten through we're dealing just with the first paragraph in the last 2 months on these four prerequisites. Did we get to the fourth, which was the Dharma door last time? No. Okay. So just a quick reminder, we are, number one was deep faith in the law of cause and effect. Again, the emphasis here is to really see how this is not a random universe, whether it's the way things develop historically or the way things develop personally or the way they develop within our own mind, that everything, every effect has a preceding cause. And when one understands that, one understands a lot. One not only understands why things occur in this world the way they do, but one also understands the keys to transformation. As I change, how I respond to the effects from my own past or the effects of the actions of others, as I change how I respond to those effects, I am creating new causes in my life. My future will be different than my past, as well as my own capacity to create very consciously new ways of thinking, new ways of being, new ways, like we're talking about loving kindness. I am also very clearly, because if this world operates on cause and effect, as I consciously create new causes in my life, my future, the effects, right, which is my future, will be different. So meditating, reflecting on the law of cause and effect, he says, is essential. Second is a strict observance of the precepts, which again means, and it probably ties into the first, we need to see how cause and effect is operating in our life, how we relate to each other in issues of violence, harm, sexuality, drugs, alcohol, speech, right? We need to see how the actions of our body, speech, and mind have effects, and we need some kind of tableau that we use as guideposts in this life so our actions are impeccable. We stop doing harm to others and ourselves. Because most of us do not have a clear vision and are still often enshrouded in our own issues and our own needs and our own egocentricity, we're often blind to the suffering we're causing ourselves and others. So therefore, really within all religious spiritual traditions, there are, you know, moral guidelines in Buddhism that are called right, guidelines to right action, which really means we stop doing those actions that cause suffering, and we do more actions that cause the opposite, that bring goodness into our life. So that's number two. And the third, which we dealt with last time, which was immovable, unshakable trust or faith in what? In our own Buddha nature, our own awakened nature, and as importantly, trusting that none of us lack the capacity to awake. To awake to what? To our... as it's said, the Tibetans call it Kunto Zampo, Samanka Bahadra, our all good nature. Our true nature is all good. It is the repository of all goodness. Each of us has that. No matter how, no matter what we've done, and what we've thought, and how much we have soiled, this immaculate, pure mind of ours. It in itself is adamantine, diamond-like. It is, you know, the diamond cannot be cut by anything else, right? It cuts. So in the same way, this true mind of ours, no matter if we've taken this beautiful diamond, and no matter how, you know, much manure and mud we have covered it over with. Right? Once we remove that manure and mud, there's the pure diamond. So that, he's saying, we need to have unshakable trust, confidence, that diamond-like mind of ours is here, and that we can realize it and manifest it. And now the fourth one, which we'll deal with tonight, he says the fourth is choosing a Dharmador method of practice. Okay? Now, this concept of a Dharmador is maybe interesting to some people. A door is what? A door is something you go through to get into some place, right? So, if we want to enter the truth, the Dharma, the truth of our own being, the truth of the universe, right? We'd like a door to go through, right? Somebody point me out a door. I want to get into that building. Now, do you know how many Dharma doors there are in Buddhism? 84,000. Anybody know all of them? Can recite them? 84,000. To say there are 84,000 Dharma doors means what? Limitless Dharma doors. Okay. So as you can see, from the time of the Buddha, he doesn't say, you know, there is only one way, right? Only one practice, only one door. You know, many religions say there's only one door, right? You know, if you want to enter the truth of our practice, you can only go through this one door. There is no other way, right? And that's fine. But Buddhism says 84,000 doors. Right? It doesn't mean that those who say there's only one door, they're wrong, right? Buddhism just says, that's true. There are just 83,999 other ones. You see, but it's not saying that that one door it's important to understand that. It's not a negation of that. It's just really saying no. Because why? Because of what we just said about number three. If the truth is imminent in everything, right? Then really, you know, there's an expression in Zen, you know, when you shoot a bow and arrow, you know, when there is no bullseye, anywhere you shoot your arrow, anywhere it lands, it's a direct hit. It's a bullseye in that sense. It's sort of like that. So when you understand that, you go, oh, the emphasis is not on, you know, whether I shoot my arrow over here, over here, over here. You know what I mean? I mean, we could. It's really about what? Yeah, the experience of shooting. That's what it's about. Right? So anywhere I shoot, any kind of target I shoot at, it's all fine, right? Because the experience is about this. So, having said that, he says, choosing a Dharmador method of practice. So at the same time, for the sake of sentient beings, because at any moment in history, and let's say for Buddhism it's more than 2,500 years of history, so that's a lot of history, a lot of countries, a lot of cultures, a lot of historical epics, right? So you can see lots of different kinds of people. So therefore, in the creative interaction, it's called upaya in Buddhism, or skillful means, we need to be creative, right, in making sure there are many accessible doors for everyone and anyone, so they can come into the building of Dharma, come into the building of awakening. Now, having said this, right, if we are on the outside, right, and we're looking at the building with 84,000 doors, right, and if you want to go inside, you do have to choose a door, don't you? Unless you want to stay out on the sidewalk. So at some point, if we want to go in the building, we've got to decide which door am I going to go in through. So in the same way that we might say, you know, many spiritual traditions, in each of the, like let's say in Buddhism, which is one of the great spiritual traditions world, within the Buddhist tradition, the Buddhist universe, many, many different traditions, lineages, meditation practices, right? But each of us have to decide which door am I going to enter through. That's what you're going to say. We cannot get in the building if we stay out on the sidewalk. So we have to, at some point, make a decision, right, about which Dharma door, which practice path do I want to commit to. And again, this is not because there's any money involved. This is not franchise. This is really for the sake of each of us. Because of our habit patterns, because of the strong binders and blinders that we've kind of covered our sight with, right? We need to commit ourselves at some point to a path that seems right for us, valid for us, doable for us, etc. And then walk it. I mean, I can have this big mound of dirt and manure, right here in front of me, and I can know that inside it there is this wonderful diamond. But you know, at some point I'm going to have to do the work if I want to have access to the diamond, right? I'm going to have to do the work of getting it out, digging it out, and clean it up, right? Now I have the diamond in my hand, I can see it, you can see it, it shines brightly, right? So, you know, knowing that I have this diamond is good, you know, it's better than not knowing, right? Knowing that I have this inheritance, knowing that I have this this possibility is wonderful to know that. It's better than not knowing it, isn't it? But there's still work to be done. And that's, again, many, many Dharma doors, many different ways of practicing, many different types of teachers, right? You know, before, you know, when you get to the building and you say, that's a nice building, I'd like to go in there. I see a bunch of doors, you know, maybe I just want to go around and check them out. Right, kind of go see different shapes, different sizes, different kinds of wood, different paints, right? Different people are, you know, are the gatekeepers at each door, right? So I may want to do a little checking things out. That's fine, right? At a certain point, kind of checking things out is good. We don't want to commit ourselves unless we are feel good about it and feel comfortable. But again, at a certain point, if we want to get off the sidewalk and we want to get into the building, we have to choose a door to enter. Right? I mean, that makes sense to everybody, right? You know, it's sort of like I mean, nothing wrong with a liberal arts education, right? It's good to kind of have a general liberal arts background, as they say. Just kind of know our culture and history, a little bit of sociology and philosophy, right? Taking different courses in different things. But all of us at some point have to decide what, if I'm going to earn a living. At some point I'm going to make a decision about what I'm going to do with the rest of my life, right? I can't go to school forever. So at some point we need to specialize, don't we? We have to make a choice. We have to make a decision about a job, a career, a path in this life, right? I'm talking about, you know, worldly life. We understand that, right? At some point we need to commit if we want to, to move into some kind of stability in terms of our livelihood and our worldly path, right? So this is really no different. Again, it is not saying that there's anything inherently wrong, but being a generalist, but again, I think at some point everybody specializes, don't they, in something. It's hard to be a specialist in everything. So it's like that. So, these are the four prerequisites concerning methods of Zen practice. Deep trust, faith in the law of cause and effect, strict observance of the trainings and the right livelihood, right action, immovable trust in one's own Buddha nature and one's capacity to realize it, and choosing the Dharma Door method of practice. Are there any questions about this before we move on?
I see some of that has happened. So, I've heard this a number of times, but it's kind of got it differently here. It's really talking about that commitment, and it, just to use your image, continue with that image, it's like, it almost seems to me like there's a hallway after the door, you know, and if you just kind of peek through the door and keep checking doors, trying to find a door that you like the best, you know, there's a gauntlet that you've got to run inside that door, and I mean, I'm looking at myself, and I really like looking at the door. I may have to run that gauntlet, you know, which is really the work that you're talking
about. Right, and again, let me just say again, this is called Methods of Practice in the Chan Hall, and it says in parentheses, this course was intended for his senior monks, okay? So let me just say, this is important to understand. Xu Yin, Empty Cloud, is talking to who? What?
Senior monks.
Yes, or we could say committed people, people who are not generalists, right? People who aren't just coming to the temple, right? All right, I'm letting off the hook, but I'm just saying, I think that is something that each of us need to go is, you know,
yeah.
Am I one of those people who go, yeah, you know, hey, just the fact that I'm on the street and I can see the 84,000 doors and I can, you know, look down the hall, I mean, you know, that's not bad, right? I mean, you know, lots of people aren't even close to this. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
So I guess what I'm trying to say to you, and then I want to hear more from you, is, you know, please understand that he's talking to people who are saying, yeah, I want what's inside that building.
Yeah.
Okay? Right. You know, so I guess what I'm saying, this is a select group. I mean, not that we're the elite or anything, but I mean, it's just that most people don't go there.
Right.
Okay, so.
Yeah, well, I get the sense of a commitment differently than I got.
Mm-hmm.
It really is a commitment to, because it is that gauntlet that you got to run inside the door. It's not the door. I
mean, right.
The door. That's the thing that's really, you can just open all those doors. These are all cool.
Yeah.
We're kind of admire the ingredients.
Right.
Or something, but it's really good. And so he is saying, so just to carry that image one step further, so it's like instead of, it's just once there is a monk or there's a person who is committed to the path, then he's saying, okay,
if we're in agreement on this, then looking at the doors doesn't work.
Right.
Because it really is, it is what's behind the door.
Right, exactly right.
And you got to, then the commitment means to step inside once you open the door. I'm just assuming that you can't get rid of it. So
right, but again, it's knowing, I mean, what he's saying, again, if you look at this, he's saying, you know, you've really contemplated cause and effect, you understand how things operate, you understand, you know, why you are where you are and how you got to where you are, and you understand that there, how it works in terms of transforming yourself. You understand how you need to start, you know, change the way you're acting and interacting with life to create the least harm. You have really looked at and believe that you have this true nature, Buddha nature, God nature, Christ nature, true mind, whatever you want to call it, and that you have the capacity to realize it. Now, you need to decide what's your vehicle, what's your, right, what door you're going to use to manifest and really realize all this. So it's not just a trust in, it's a realization of.
And to not waver after that. I mean, that, at least that's what I'm saying. Is that, am I talking?
No, of course. I mean, the more you've done this foundation work, the least wavering you'll do. I mean, that's why, again, and I've said it, you know, a number of times now, this is why traditionally in the meditative path, the path of the awakening, preliminary practices, prerequisite kind of contemplations are considered essential because they kind of get it together. And after you get it together, it's sort of like, you know, the sailing is smoother because the commitment is there, the clarity is there, you know where you've been, you know where you're going, it's like that. It'll just make it a lot easier. And the reason, I think I said when I first introduced this, and you've heard me say it before, the reason so many of us, as the years go by, find we progress, we're committed, we're not committed, we're on, we're off, is often because we just haven't gotten this all down. So that kind of consistent energy and application, isn't coming from the inside. And we really, what you want to get to that point is, in the early days of our practice, having external supports, having all this stuff is very helpful and meaningful. But at a certain point, we want the energy to be internally driven. And then he's kind of setting it forth. So now, are there any questions about the... yes, Carol.
This question is kind of weirdly, like, does it mean that you should concentrate on one set of teachers rather than reading Zen and then reading Tibetan and then reading engaged Buddhism? It's not confusing, but I find that everyone scatters when I
think you've answered your question. Right? Again, this is not high orthodoxy, this is not dogmatic, so certainly a willingness to, read different things and expose yourself. But at a certain point, if you want to perfect anything, right, it's not just your meditation practice, your spiritual practice, you want to perfect anything, you have to focus. Right? And focus means what? Discipline. Discipline means what? Repetitive. Right? If you want to get good at something, you just have to keep doing it over and over, right? So at a certain point, when you get to that point, if you get to that point, one has to make that commitment. And at that point, what might have been enjoyable, reading a little this, reading a little that, being slow to this, becomes scattering. Right? And it's good to focus. It doesn't mean other times, in your life, it may be good again to get broader views or see things in different ways. But when you want to go through that door, you want to be very focused on going through that door and walking that, walking that path. Anybody else? I don't know. Somehow Andy's pointing. I'm kind of thought he was pointing behind. I'm sorry.
Carol,
must be these glasses.
Carol, I'm curious.
Carol is going to ask my question.
Okay.
But I just want to, like, you know, pummel it again here just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because as the Sangha, we've gone through many different practices, through breath practice,
mm-hmm.
spirit, with an intensive. And now what I'm finding is that I'm revisiting the metta practice in an intense way. And when I do these things, at this stage, a lot of it seems like it's all the same. You know, it has really, you know, it has a different method that is really all driving home the point. And what happens when I start a new kind of direction or a new teaching is that it freshens it up. That's one point of the thing. But what it sounds like you're saying is a lot of different things, actually. It sounds like...
Yeah, again, what I'm saying is it's not like only one practice. It's saying what you find in all the different lineages and traditions is there's a certain coherency, that certain kinds of teachings and practices have been put together, right? Like today, I mean, we practice mindful sitting, mindful walking, mindfulness of the breath, right? Mindfulness of the body, awareness, loving kindness practice, right? I mean, it's even those practices, you see, there are three or four or five practices that we might say, but yet there's a coherency to them. They all nicely dovetail with one another, right? If I introduce now Sufi dancing, Christian-centered prayer, again, all, you know, good stuff, but at the doors. So it's kind of saying, you know, it's not like this, but it's sort of saying, you know, these paths have a certain coherency with them, the way they've been practiced for years, and each of them, if they're valid practices, have a capacity for transformation of the mind and the heart. Right? So it's not like... Okay? Now, again, yet I would add that if he's on a retreat talking to his monks, he is probably talking about one practice now, because these guys are on retreat. So he's probably saying, you know, in a very narrow way, one Dharma door. And you put all your energy into that. But, I mean, I think in generally, like we're talking, I think it's more a coherent path, and we're not just all over the place. And some people are all over the place, and they enjoy it, that's fine. You know, they like to take a little from this, a little from that, and mix it all together, and that's all. Yes.
If you're doing that, how do you go deep enough into the teaching to take transformative changes?
If you're doing what?
You're jumping around.
I don't know. I mean, my experience with to be honest with you, having been in this spiritual field now 30 or 40 years, and I mean, even though my path has always been very clear, but knowing lots of different people and you know, friends in different ways, you know, my sense, a lot of people do disco horizontally. You know, over the years, they just accumulate a lot of knowledge and they have a lot of experience and practices, but the real deep transformation does not occur just for that reason. Again, I don't think I'm saying anything that unique, right?
What do you think about it, like searching yourself and studying other people and maybe studying yourself? You'll eventually find the door, you'll know
sort of. Well, again, I think, I think it is very hard. If you're saying, can we do it on our own?
Sure.
I don't think so. Now, having said that, you know, are there some people? But even the some, you know, I'm just thinking of, you know, a guy like Eckhart Tolle, right? Very popular, maybe people, most everybody knows Eckhart Tolle, and if you know, you know, The Power of Now, and, you know, very popular. And if you read his book, he had a very, very personal transformative experience that came out of his own dealing with his own suffering. Now, if you know his story, you know what I mean, in his own depth. But yet, if you also read, you realize he's read a lot, and he's been exposed to different spiritual paths. And if you listen to his teaching, you go, oh, this is Zen, or this is Buddhism, or this is... So I guess what I'm saying, is it possible that people on their own can very successfully transform themselves? Just through their own self-analysis, self-awareness? Sure, everything is possible. But I would say, because of our own capacity for self-deception, and because how difficult it is often to see ourselves, you know, it is the hardest thing to see. We are much better at seeing the shortcomings, faults, delusions, illusions of others, right? But you might have noticed along the way, especially if you've gotten feedback from other people in your life, that we're often blind to our own stuff. Because why? Because it's our stuff. It's so close to us. Do you know what I mean? So that's why often we need some kind of path, something that holds up a mirror that to kind of guide us. Again, am I talking about, rote learning and being a robot or being a cult follower? No, I'm not saying that at all. I mean, to me, if you're following a valid spiritual path, you're doing a lot of self-introspection. Right? You're doing a lot of, I mean, it's all about. But at least you have kind of a guideline, right? You have kind of, again, I'm just talking about Buddhism, but that's the path I know. You have 2,500 years of accumulated experience with what? With human beings transforming themselves. Right, as well as you have a community of people to support you and to mirror you. You have teachers to guide you and to hold up a mirror to you. So it's a kind of...
If you don't kind of get it to begin with, if you do a little research and you listen to someone like you and read the book, you're eventually going to get to, because they're asking a lot of questions, it seems like they're not there yet, but you will get there.
Yeah, again, hopefully. You know, it's again, remember, you know, our individual yearning for transformation isn't occurring in a vacuum. I mean, we have our own stuff from the past that we're dealing with that may be pulling us this way and that way, as well as we live in a society that has very different values other than self-actualization. So, there are probably people in this room. I mean, it's just interesting. I mean, I'm somebody in my 60s, but... there are a lot of people who I run into who are coming to the Dharma these days, who are people who said, I just ran into a guy not too long ago, he was telling me, oh, you know, I practiced Vipassana, when I was in my 20s, in the 70s, And kind of, and then kind of life just took them off, you know what I'm saying? Isn't that? And now it's, 35 years later. And, they're at a different stage of their life, and now they're kind of coming back. Why? Because, life took them away. So I guess what I'm saying, yes, but it may not be that easy. So that's why, again, to find a path, again, that you've done your homework, you've done your research, you've done the path that you feel comfortable with, to find a community to support you, to find a teacher to kind of guide you and hold a mirror, that kind of, what can I say, greater percentage of follow-through and success. Again, not to say that, people can't do it on their own. I mean, I'm really not discounting that. I'm saying that it is very difficult that way. Does that answer your question? Well, what's not clear? What?
It was the question on the I just heard of some questions, and what I was saying was, by doing the research, listening to gentlemen like yourself, listening to their questions, but if you listen to the stuff, you do the research, eventually, hopefully, like you said, you'll get to this place where there's enlightenment, whatever, something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Where you're going to really get it, and you're going to know which way to go.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. Yeah. Again, you know, we're all different. You know, some of us. Yeah. Some of us get it. You know, it's all very clear. Some of us, it's murkier. I mean, it's all. You know, we're all individuals, and our patterns. Are, you know, it's yeah. So. Yeah. Good. Any other questions? So. So then he goes into the essentials of Zen practice. It's interesting, he talks about, he says, our everyday activities are executed within the path, capital P, itself. Is there anywhere that is not a place for practicing the path, which means the path of awakening? Okay? So he's thinking from absolute, from the point of absolute truth and realization, right? Each of us have a true nature. Each of us has never been separate. We're all inherently Buddhas. And that reality and that fact is apparent anywhere, right? So he says, you know, we can just go about our everyday life. Then he goes on to say, a Zen hall, a Chan hall, a meditation hall, shouldn't even be necessary. You know, why do we have to come to this, like we do tonight, right? And take these uncomfortable positions, and, you know what I mean? And go through all this, and you know, why should we have to? Why can't we just go about our everyday life and be fully realized Buddhas? Yeah. So he says, he says, you know, it's not just sitting; it's everything in one's life. So he says, the Zen hall, the Chan hall, and Zen sitting meditation are for sentient beings with deep karmic obstructions and shallow wisdom. Okay, so that's us. So he's saying, and he's speaking to the whole group, he's saying, yeah, he's like saying to you, you're absolutely right, we're all inherently Buddhas, none of us really need to be here, right? But yet, obviously, you know, we're a bunch of losers. And so, you know, places like this exist for people like us. He's going to say, all right. And then the first thing he says, when one sits in meditation, one must first know how to regulate the body and mind. And then he goes on to talking about, you know, sort of the things that we've all begun to understood, that we need to learn the basic practices of posture, you know, to find a good stable posture, and to find basic practices of our mind, breath practice, awareness practices, basic practices that can stabilize and unify the body-mind. I mean, he goes on, but he talks about postures and erect back, but this is basically, again, what he's saying, again, as a basic before we go into the practice. He talks about how sometimes you may be sleepy and how to open your eyes wide, straighten your back, move your buttocks from side to side, and the dullness in your mind will gradually vanish. He also says if you find that you get annoyed or agitated or kind of get tight in the practice, it's good probably just to put it all down for a few moments, take some breath, just relax, kind of nourish yourself, and then start over. So he's again talking about if the mind gets dull or torpid, or if the mind gets too agitated, there are things that one can do. And then he goes on to say that, you know, if you involve yourself consistently with meditation practice and it deepens, you'll have many experiences. You'll have good ones, you'll have bad ones. You may have visions, you may think you hear the voice of God, lights, you may have all kinds of, you may feel you have a body, you may feel you don't have a body, you may have all kinds of experiences. And he quotes a proverb, see the extraordinary, yet do not think of it as being extraordinary, and the extraordinary will retreat. So this is, and then he says, if you encounter, perceive an unpleasant experience, take no notice of it, and have no fear. If you experience something pleasant, take no notice of it, and don't give rise to fondness. Okay. So basically, and this is again something that is somewhat unique to Zen, Because in some meditation traditions, having these kinds of experiences are considered good results, right? To have an out-of-body experience, to think you're hearing angelic choruses or angelic music, to see a great light show appearing before your eyes, to have recollections of past lifetimes or future lifetimes, or any other kind of hallucination one may have of any type, may be considered something wonderful, right? But in Zen, it's not. These are just considered impediments. And as you said, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, extraordinary or ordinary, don't be attached to them. Don't make a big deal about them. Just let them go. Because our practice is what? We want to get to the source of things. Right? If you want to get to the source of things, you don't dawdle along the path. And all these various kinds of experiences that often happen in the course of meditation, while they may be interesting, are simply just phenomena arising. They have in and of themselves nothing intrinsically wonderful, nor something intrinsically terrible. Because in Zen we are learning how to live like Buddha right here. We are not preparing ourselves for an alternative reality. We are not preparing ourselves for the life afterwards. The object of Buddhist meditation is to realize one's Buddhahood in the imminence of your life right now. So in that case, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, the true miracle is not to walk on the water. The true miracle is to walk on the earth. That's the true miracle. But to experience the miraculous nature of oneself in this life, one has to let go of everything that gets in the way of seeing that and experiencing that. So again, the Master Empty Cloud Shu Yun is saying, in terms of your meditation, you may have lots of different experiences, good ones, bad ones, pleasant, unpleasant, profound, profane. Just let them go. Don't make a big deal. It's not what it's about. So why don't we stop here, and next week, when I come in 2 weeks, we'll begin the section of now beginning Zen practice. Okay, we've gone through all the prerequisites, and now it's called How to Start the Practice, Distinction Between Host and Guest. It's a very profound teaching. So we'll do that when I come back in 2 weeks. Thank you.